everyone, and welcome once again to Commerce Experience. I'm your host, Brian Walker, Chief Strategy Officer at Bloomreach, and thank you for being here. Today, I want to talk about Amazon, and specifically the question of whether we have reached peak Amazon. Has Amazon, in a sense, reached its height of market share, and are we about to see a decline? I recently wrote about this in my new newsletter, Cocktails, Commerce, and Conversions, where I'm combining my love of mixology with analysis of the digital commerce and marketing landscape. Every week on the newsletter, I'm sharing a favorite cocktail or mocktail recipe, along with some deep analysis or great links to content you don't want to miss out there. If you're interested, you can find it on Substack at Cocktails And, or find it via my LinkedIn profile or Twitter. And unlike some Substack newsletters, mine is ungated and free. Now, I appreciate all the great feedback I've received on the newsletter and specifically my piece on Amazon, and I thought maybe I should share some of that here as well. So let's get into it. So the central question we want to really address here is, as I said, have we reached peak Amazon? I've been thinking and reflecting about Amazon a lot lately. For years, of course, Amazon has been an unstoppable e-commerce juggernaut with innovation mojo and an investment thesis that gave them license to spin Bezos' legendary flywheel so fast that no one could keep up. But now, in my opinion, that mojo has turned to mush. The Amazon.com customer experience has gone from bar raiser to below average. Even the mainstream media has caught on to it, with everyone from the Wall Street Journal to the Intelligencer to the Atlantic to the New York Times writing about the frustration of search that does not work, fake reviews, BS ads everywhere, knockoff products, and routinely missed delivery promise dates. And of course, customers are noticing. In 2021, Amazon's CSI score fell to an all-time low on the American Customer Satisfaction Index. Amazon's score decreased to 78 out of 100, its worst performance since the year 2000. So in other words, Amazon's e-commerce experience is now mediocre and suddenly seems to have developed a very real customer trust problem. And honestly, you know, pains me to say it. I worked there. And though I left after a few thousand cups of coffee and a lot of challenging experiences and learnings and some funny stories I still tell, what was clear when I worked there? Well, the customer experience was the most important thing, period. There was an expectation at Amazon to differentiate through a maniacal focus on delivering great customer experiences. Frankly, that was non-negotiable. So why can't Amazon just get refocused and bring back some of that hair-on-fire passion for the customer that they once had? Why can't a few Andy emails in the style of Jeff emails kick some people in the butt and get the customer experience sorted? Well, because they're in a trap. It's a complex trap that sets Amazon up for a painful awakening to a new day in Amazon's history, where retail market share starts to slip and Amazon's increasingly becomes a back end, a tech infrastructure and fulfillment, and thus growth and margins will slowly erode. The sun is rising on day two, Bezos' much quoted vision for a descent into stasis, mediocrity, and quote unquote, death, which he even wrote about in his 2016 shareholder letter. I'm not alone in thinking that this may be true. For example, John Rossman, also a friend and someone who was an early guest on this podcast and who has written numerous books on Amazon, recently wrote a very insightful piece about on his Substack, one that you should check out. John very smartly recommends that there's a lot Amazon can do to trim expenses and try to save the culture. But it's very hard to escape a trap so well laid by yourself that you've perfectly backed yourself into a corner. And that, in my opinion, is what Amazon has done. What are the elements of the trap? Well, let's explore. The first part of the trap is Amazon's advertising trap. In Q4 2022, Amazon's digital ad business grew by 19%, propelling the company to the third spot in the global ad market with 7.3% share and a $38 billion annual business. While this growth has benefited from Meta's Faceplant, the reality is that Amazon's advantage over all of its ad competitors, except perhaps Google, is that its advertising is more effective than poorly targeted display or social ads. Customers show very clear intent when they're searching on Amazon or Google or your website. Targeting based on that, well, that's money. And subtle mention here, that's also why Bloomreach's product discovery solution is so effective too. But how do you keep growing a high margin ad business? Well, you create more ad slots. And in case you have not noticed, Amazon can already feel like it's all ad slots. Well, you know, that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but not by much. Now, I'm not vilifying ads. I'm fine with a few. But when you allow merchants to bid on keywords and brands without regard for what the customers are searching for, I don't even need to answer that. You get it. To make matters worse, every retailer at scale is trying to copy the model and launch their own retail media networks. I'm not a big fan. Amazon will need to continue expanding and improving its advertising offerings to keep advertisers happy and spending more while also allocating a larger portion of their budget and resources to this high margin ad platform. In my view, this is like chasing your next fix and is not going to help rescue the customer experience, which in many ways is diametrically opposed to growing your ad platform. In my opinion, it's time for some tough love and for Amazon to kick the ad habit or else. And to be honest, I don't think that's going to be easy. And it connects to the second part of the trap. The second part of the trap, offshore third-party marketplace sellers. Now, you have to admit that Bezos and team made a very bold bet to sunset auctions in Z Shops and launch the marketplace model. Z Shops, back in the day, was such a spectacular failure that Jeff Bezos reportedly quipped that only he and his parents had ever visited a Z Shop. And the marketplace model, when they implemented it, ended up unlocking tremendous opportunities for Amazon and value for its shareholders. But unlike eBay, Amazon worked to ensure that there was one product page for each common product. An Amazon SKU is called an ASIN, an Amazon Standard Identification Number. And a white 16-gigabyte iPod is a white 16-gigabyte iPod, no matter who's selling it. Amazon set up competition over the buy box and invited sellers large and small to compete for it by offering the lowest cost and fastest delivery, including competing against Amazon itself. It may seem funny to say it now, but that was frankly mind-blowing at the time, and I can remember arguments at Amazon while I was there about whether it was even a good idea. Now today, a remarkable 6 out of 10, 60% of units sold on Amazon.com are from third-party merchants selling through the Amazon marketplace. Amazon does not carry the inventory. Instead, it charges extra for storage and fulfillment services and finds all kinds of ways to gamify the buy box and get merchants to spend more with Amazon to eke out sales. They, of course, take a percent of every sale as well. Now, this is like a modern form of indentured servitude, as these merchants spend money and labor to give more of their margin to Amazon than even themselves, all for a sip of that precious traffic. And which merchants are in the best position to share that margin with Amazon and be happy with it? Well, manufacturers, and specifically offshore manufacturers. Manufacturers are used to selling those goods wholesale to Western brands and retailers primarily. Why not sell direct through Amazon or Shopify or eBay for that matter and get more margin and start to build your own brand? Pre-pandemic, this motion became endemic as Amazon provided a well-oiled channel for offshore manufacturers to sell direct to consumers through its marketplace. And by offshore, I am primarily referring to China, but of course, not exclusively. But of course, Chinese manufacturers had the advantage of infrastructure and manufacturing hubs to make this model work uniquely well for them. Amazon even invested in technology and services to help them export out of China to the United States efficiently. Now, two-day shipping from China was within reach for these manufacturers to reach the vast hordes of American consumers hungry for inexpensive goods that were essentially knockoffs of the same products those manufacturers made for leading brands and retailers' private label programs. These manufacturers also took full advantage of Amazon's ad programs and paid for all the services that led them to appear on the first search results page or to win that buy box and bump everyone else out, including what you may have actually been shopping for and searching for on Amazon. Even in obscure categories, success on Amazon became hugely lucrative for these manufacturers, and of course, Amazon. And many of their customers benefited as well, even if they had no idea that that weird brand that they had never heard of was shipping from China and clearing customs electronically with the help of Amazon on some tarmac somewhere like Riverside, California, or Memphis, Tennessee, or Castle Donington, UK. Of course, that optimized process to get goods from China and deliver this at scale and low cost, well, the pandemic kind of messed that up. Suddenly, the experience turned to, well, kind of crap. And the monitoring and reporting systems that Amazon built to try to ensure the customer experience did not suffer, well, they were of no help. And this is one of the primary reasons why Amazon's CSI score cratered in 2020. Missed delivery and poor service, that can do that. The reliance on third-party sellers, many of, if not most of which are offshore, and the sheer scale of the program is now a trap. And that's, of course, true when you pair it with the ad platform and you pair it with the scale of the fulfillment network built up around it, which leads us to the next part of the trap. The third part of the trap, Amazon's private label programs paired with politics and antitrust pressure. A lot's been made about Amazon's own private label programs competing with retailers and brands on that Amazon marketplace. Amazon now has over 200 of their own private label brands. Yes, that is a challenge for those seeing their products copied by Amazon Basics, Essentials, Mama Bear, Solimo, etc. And that walled garden that supposedly kept marketplace seller data from Amazon's own retail private label merchants and buyers? Well, yeah, I'm not so sure. But frankly, that was smart of Amazon, and in my opinion, not anything any other retailers have not done before as they launch their own private label programs, even if the antitrust regulators may feel differently. And of course, this narrative is not really all that new. We've been talking about that for a while. But Amazon has now become an easy target for politicians of all parties and stripes across the US, UK, and Europe. Despite having between 1 and 200 lobbyists and spending $169 million in 2021 on lobbying in the US alone, that is mind-boggling. Frankly, Amazon is now an easy mark for American and European antitrust regulators to show that they're on the job, and the pressure is mounting to take a chunk of Amazon's hide. The Wall Street Journal recently reported that the U.S. Federal Trade Commission is in fact getting set to bring an antitrust lawsuit against Amazon in the next few months. Now, that lawsuit may target a range of Amazon's business practices as being anti-competitive, but I'm pretty sure that number one on the list will likely be how Amazon has structured the marketplace, its retail model, and its private label programs. Now, I'm no antitrust expert, and there's probably many aspects of any prospective case that may mean it has low prospects for success. And frankly, I'm not even sure that I like the idea of suing Amazon for this. But any lawsuit will likely take many years to play out, and with an expected appeal of 2 or 3. And whether the case is successful or not, it's going to take a long time to play out, and it's going to be a PR nightmare and cement the public's suspicions that Amazon does not play fair. It will erode their brand and impact market share. Calls to shop elsewhere will intensify and play into the hands of Amazon's competitors. The many brands who may still sell on Amazon will be encouraged to drop off and go direct or through the many other alternative marketplaces out there now. And just as Cambridge Analytica scandal led to a large number of Facebook users to delete their accounts, you could certainly see a growing call for Amazon's Prime members to cancel their subscriptions. Though, probably, they'll renew them after their second cocktail and their kids begging them to watch something on Amazon Prime. Amazon is like a body where all the different interconnected systems converge in a semblance of multi-dependent balance despite the incredible odds. One problem like that can have lots of ripple effects, which leads us to the next trap. The next part of the trap is spinning off AWS, which will cripple the economics of the retail business. Many have made the argument that Amazon has become a company with two competing narratives. The retail side of the business is struggling to find growth and profitability, while the cloud computing side is in the midst of a battle royale with Microsoft Azure and Alphabet's Google Cloud. Overall, in 2022, Amazon's business increased 9% to $514 billion. In 2022, the retail marketplace business grew 13% in North America to $316 billion, while the international business decreased 8% to $118 billion. Both of these lost money, however, with the North American segment losing $2.8 billion and the international segment losing $7.7 billion in 2022. Meanwhile, the AWS division sales increased 29% in 2022 to $80.1 billion with an operating income of $22.8 billion. Now, Gartner is expecting the worldwide end-user spending on public cloud services like AWS to reach $592 billion in 2023, growing at 21% from 2022. Gartner estimated Amazon has 38% market share of the public cloud market in 2021, capturing a lion's share, but growing slower than its competitors and with some relative weaknesses. The acceleration of the hype cycle around generative AI and the growing complexity of multi-cloud architectures mean that Amazon has a huge fight on its hands, and many will claim that AWS is where the real long-term value is in the Amazon stock, whether there is an antitrust consideration or not. If an independent AWS were valued relatively conservatively for a tech provider, say 10x, it would command a market cap today of over $800 billion US dollars. Amazon's current total market cap is just over $1 trillion. That is a pretty strong case right there. If Amazon.com needs to pay market rates for a variable cloud computing infrastructure with massive seasonal spikes, or for warehouse space for that matter, expect those losses in the retail business to be far greater, and for the value of a separate Amazon retail marketplace business to be valued accordingly, and thus have far less capital and resources to work with. And how about the talent required? What software engineer or hotshot business leader wants to stay with the retail business, and who wants to go with AWS? Whoever is left inside the spheres last stays. It's a bloodbath, which leads us to the next part of the trap. The last part of the trap, it is the war for talent. Amazon was once on the short list of every MBA or computer science graduate. It was famously hard to get hired there into a management role or at headquarters. Everyone knew that Amazon was a tough place to work, but they wanted that, or they thought they did. But they also knew that the salaries were modest and the titles were kept low, meaning that a manager at Amazon would have been a director anywhere else, and a director at Amazon would have easily been a VP or higher somewhere else. The quid pro quo was a combo of resume building and equity. The RSUs were where it was all at, and as long as the stock kept climbing, those RSUs could lead to transformational outcomes for nearly everyone who had them. And for top talent, that was even more true. And of course, the vesting schedules and follow-on grants would ensure anyone would think twice before they left. But what happens when the stock stalls or stumbles, or the business gets split up? It can mean that the calculus on staying or joining in the first place can look very different. And of course, Amazon attracted a highly competitive winner-take-all mentality that took pride in working hard to make a winner, even if for some it came at the price to pay in their personal lives or well-being. To be perfectly honest, I've always defended the work culture at Amazon. I had what I would say was an overall good experience, but that was not always true for all, including friends of mine. And when the equation shifts and the upside is not there and you no longer feel the pride of winning, expect Amazon to lose more key talent and have a harder time competing to replace them. Amazon is at the forefront of automation and computer science, but someone has to write and optimize the software and design the strategies to win in the market. Falling behind in the war of talent will set another trap for Amazon. So have we reached peak Amazon.com? Yes, I think so. Amazon accounted for an estimated 39.5% of all U.S. e-commerce sales in 2022, or nearly $2 in $5 spent online. That is crazy. The next 14 digital commerce retailers make up just 31% market share, with the remaining 29.5% of U.S. e-commerce pie going everywhere else. That's amazing domination that Amazon has achieved. In every annual report, Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos famously attached a copy of his original 1997 letter to shareholders. In that 1997 letter, Bezos outlined the fundamental measures of Amazon's potential success: relentlessly focusing on customers, creating long-term value over short-term corporate profit, and making many bold bets. He is quoted in there, I'm quoting him, "This is day one for the internet, and if we execute well, for Amazon.com." Those principles have remained consistent now for over two decades and lie at the heart of what has been known at Amazon as the day one mentality. Day one is even the name of one of Amazon's headquarter buildings in Seattle, so that employees don't forget it. The steady decline of the customer experience, in my opinion, it's the canary in the coal mine, telling us that Amazon.com needs to fix things fast if it wants to hang on to that kind of market share or grow it. And yet, as we have explored here, Amazon has set a complex trap for itself in trying to rectify the challenges they face and still satisfy Wall Street, their employees, and their egos. Day two is, in fact, in my opinion, dawning at Amazon. Amazon will remain, of course, a hugely important player in the e-commerce landscape and a force to reckon with. But I expect market share and market power to decline versus grow. And that, of course, is an opportunity for everyone else to execute with common sense and a focus on first principles. Great products, great product discovery, focus on the long-term customer relationships, and meeting and exceeding those promises you make to customers. Just do yourselves a favor and don't chase Amazon into the corners, like overcooking your marketplace and retail media strategies. Now, anything like this, I think it's fair to say, would not be complete unless we evaluate what Amazon could do to rectify this situation. Bezos, and of course many others who worked alongside him, built an incredible business with a combination of good old-fashioned grit, a focus on simple, clear goals that were based on those same kind of first principles, and a long-term vision investors were patient to let play out, because it made sense, and Amazon developed credibility through steady progress. Some might claim Bezos created a reality distortion field over Wall Street by using Chinese balloons broadcasting his laugh. Well, I don't know, maybe that's true, but I think it was really based on trust in delivering over the long haul. Now, it's going to be incredibly hard, but honestly, the only hope for Amazon.com's e-commerce experience is to get back to what really matters: a maniacal focus on delivering a highly relevant, trustworthy experience. It'll be very hard to see the ad business and its high margin contribution shrink. It will be incredibly difficult to see selection decrease as the high bar for quality, authenticity, and reliability is reestablished. It will be hard to invest in core e-commerce tech that is only for Amazon.com and not somehow leveraged with AWS's customers. And of course, it would be disingenuous for me to say here that there is no way for Amazon to get their e-com mojo back, but I do need to be honest. I'm not that hopeful. The traps they set were too good. Don't follow them into them. Now, with that, I hope you enjoyed this look at Amazon here on the podcast. I do encourage you to check out my newsletter, Cocktails, Commerce, and Conversions. And thank you so much for joining me here on the podcast. Be safe, be well. Here's to good business.